From the Sky News Centre at 5, George Clooney has been arrested outside the Sudanese embassy in Washington. The actor, his father and other human rights activists were detained for civil disobedience and charged with crossing a police line. They were protesting against a Sudanese blockade, which they say is creating a humanitarian crisis for 500,000 people. Before he was arrested, George Clooney said he had two clear aims.
We need humanitarian aid to be allowed into the Sudan before it becomes the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The second thing we are here to ask is for the government in Khartoum to stop randomly killing its own innocent men, women, and children.
School children and workers fell silent today as Belgium held a day of mourning for the 28 victims of the Swiss road crash. Meanwhile, investigators examining the incident say there's no evidence to back up reports the driver was distracted by using a DVD player. A Wiltshire town's come to a halt to pay respects to six British soldiers killed in Afghanistan and to see off their comrades who are about to be deployed. 400 soldiers from 3rd Battalion, the Yorkshire Regiment, paraded through Warminster and attended a church service there. The search is now on for the next Archbishop of Canterbury after Dr. Rowan Williams said he'd stand down. It brings to an end the decade he spent as leader of the church that has been divided over equality, sexuality and gender. That's the latest.
You can listen to BCFM live on the internet and also download every show as a podcast at bcfm.org.uk.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Bishopston, Dr. David Willingham. Political economist Polly Winch is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, was it really a bridge too far, as the title of Cornelius Ryan's book and Robert E. Levine's film imply? We go back 68 years into the heat of World War II as the Allies were fighting towards Germany and ask, why did the tanks of the British Guards Armoured Division at Nijmegen Bridge take a 17-hour break instead of pressing ahead to Arnhem along an almost open road to relieve the surrounded British paratroopers at the Arnhem Bridge? It was only a 20-minute drive away. We dedicate an hour to eyewitness and expert testimony that suggests the title of Bridge Too Far for the biggest airborne operation in history may have been about saving the face of some of the Allied generals who made critical mistakes in Operation Market Garden. The paratroopers nearly pulled it off, but were they let down by their senior officers? That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 10 Celsius, a fairly cloudy weekend with some light showers. Next week, highs of 13 and plenty of sunny spells. Next weekend is the 24th and the 25th of March. That's highs of 11 Celsius with sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, before I introduce this week's councillor, guest and Polly, we have an event tonight called Hard Press. This is organised by the Festival of Ideas and the Bristol branch of the National Union of Journalists. It's called Hacked to Bits, Rebuilding Public Trust in Journalism After Phone Hacking. And it's called the Ben Debate of 2012. It features Christopher Jeffries, who was libelled by several newspapers over the Joe Yates murder, and various other people, including Lord Hunt, the chairman of the Press Complaints Commission. Very timely, since the Press Complaints Commission has just been dissolved. So this is all going on at the Arnolfini at 7:30 this evening. There may still be tickets for that. So, time to introduce our guest tonight, and that's David Willingham, who's Lib Dem councillor for Bishopston. Hi, David. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
First of all, let's plunge in at the deep end here, because we've got some big changes that are being proposed at the moment. One is the mayor, and the other is a police commissioner. Can you just give us your thoughts on those, whether they're both good for democracy and going to be good for Bristol?
Well, with the police commissioner, it's very hard to say. These seem to be ideas that have come across from the US, in fact both of them, and I think the idea of elected mayors, elected police commissioners, comes from places like New York, but most parts of America don't really have elected officials that are that powerful, I don't think. From a police commissioner point of view, Avon and Somerset is a very diverse area. You have the heart of rural Somerset, and you have inner city areas like Bristol, and I think it's going to be a challenge to find someone that can represent both of those very different needs. With regard to the elected mayor, at a time when we're trying to save money through austerity measures, I wonder the actual value of employing a 71st person when there are already 70 councillors on Bristol City Council. If 70 people can't run this city, and I think that the minority administration that I'm part of is actually doing a pretty good job, then what's the 71st person going to achieve other than having an even greater pay packet and not necessarily any extra powers?
So, I mean, what we're seeing is there's different, possibly a tension there between the people who are elected every year. In fact, almost every year we have elections in the city. There are about, I think, is it 60 councillors or something? There's certainly loads of them. But then how does that actually square with the idea of having one specific elected person to do what is effectively a similar job?
It doesn't really seem to make sense. I mean, if you look at Bristol, what people perceive to be Bristol as an area, it incorporates parts of North Somerset, parts of Baines, and parts of South Gloucestershire. And the concept of an elected mayor may actually be perceived as being threatening to how this city works with them, because at the moment the portfolio holders in each of those regions can build working relationships with the cabinet members in Bristol. Under this situation, under the elected mayor, the proposals, you've got one person who's not really got any more powers, has a lot of responsibility. And really, do you want one person in charge of a £1 billion budget? I would rather see the 70 councillors who are elected three by thirds, so they're one third of the council is elected every year, and then for 3 years, and then there's a 1 year break.
That's this year. This year is pretty.
And that's this year. But we now have an election because and a referendum. So, in theory, you would save some money as well by not having an elected mayor. I think the cost is something like £90,000 to £100,000 per year if you take the cost of the elected mayor over the 4 year term. Do we really want to be spending that much more money on having one more elected official? It doesn't seem to make financial sense to me. And really, at the moment, Bristol City Council is a minority administration. Barbara Jank is the leader, but it's governed by consent of the other parties. If the other parties decided that they did not want the Lib Dems running Bristol City Council, given the current situation, they could vote us as a party out of office and put in a different cabinet of their choice. They have chosen not to do that, but we as a council, as a party, recognise that we are governing by consent of the other parties. We can't push things through. We couldn't push through the budget on our own. With an elected mayor, if you actually wanted to stop one person making those changes, you would need a two-thirds of the council to change the budget. And I'm not convinced that it's as democratically accountable. If you look at London, which is not an ideal comparison because there are different powers for London, you have all of these GLA members, but everybody focuses on what Boris Johnson or previously Ken Livingstone was trying to do, and they didn't. You have these other elected people who are effectively councillors, and I would guess that the vast majority of Londoners don't know who their elected GLA members are and what they do. It seems that you're having yet another tier of government. You know, Bristol has one tier of local government. There's a lot of efficiency there. If you look at places with three tiers, where you have a parish council, a district council, and a county council, you're paying three sets of organisations to do the same job, whereas we're achieving a local policy setting through neighbourhood partnerships, because we recognise that what's right for Easton and what's right for Lawrence Hill is not the same as what's right for Ashley, what's necessarily right for Bishopston, what's right for Redland. All of these different parts of the city have got different needs, different aspirations, and different concerns that their communities want addressed.
Okay, so this May, we haven't got the usual local council elections, but we do have an election to see if people want to have a mayor, and also for a police commissioner. How do you think it's all going to go?
It's very difficult to say. It's my personal hope, and I know this is a personal opinion. I know the party hasn't expressed an opinion. Is that for the reasons that I've given, I hope the people of Bristol will consider that the fact that they get two opportunities in 2 years to elect their local councillors will mean that they will vote no and keep with the system that we've got. I mean, if you want to look, I think we may discuss this later, but if you look at what South Gloucestershire are doing, they actually want to move to having more councillors having the decision making through a committee system, the previous committee system. So we have South Gloucestershire looking at more democracy, and the government effectively trying to force Bristol and bribe Bristol or cajole Bristol into having an elected mayor that I'm not convinced will be able to deliver.
Okay, let's talk about you. What brought you into politics?
What brought me into politics? I was a cyclist. I was a resident back in London. I was a keen cyclist, and I wanted to try and persuade my local authority to stop people parking so that they blocked some cycle lanes that were to bypass a chicane, so you have two-way traffic going through one lane where it's very dangerous for cycling. To try and cycle through against the flow of traffic with a bus, and people would insist on parking so you couldn't cycle through there. And I went to my local authority's equivalent of a neighbourhood partnership and campaigned to try and change that, and I think I just got dragged in. I'm not a qualified politician. I didn't go to university and read politics, so I come from it from sort of more practical experience. But I think people often complain about things, but they don't say, well, what should we do instead? And I think part of that is not just saying, I don't like this. It's saying, I don't like this. I think we need to change this. This is wrong. And it's just how to try and improve people's lives. You're never going to please everybody, but it's just trying to represent people sometimes who don't have a voice of their own or find it very difficult to represent themselves. One of the very strange things I discovered when I was elected to Bristol City Council is that I am a corporate parent for all of the over 700 children in care that the council looks after. It's quite a daunting responsibility that you find, but it shows you the diversity of responsibilities of a local authority. You know, we look after everything from abandoned vehicles to zoo licensing. We have, I think, approximately 16,000 employees, a turnover of £1 billion a year, and the turnout in local elections is quite low. Yet you're voting on someone that manages part of that £1 billion budget. It is really important, and that's where I come at it from. And it's just representing your local constituents.
Yes, but why did you choose the Liberal Democrat Party then? This is the $64,000 question, rather than one of the other parties.
Well, I always found that the other parties are much more authoritarian in what they're very much more you must do this, you must do that, whereas I didn't really fit with that. The Liberal Democrats have got a good green agenda and are much more inclusive of people from all manner of backgrounds. They're not tied to the trade unions, but they don't say we're not having unions. So it's a much more accessible party to far more people. If you look at the diversity of councillors we've got all sorts of people. It's tolerant, and it has been tolerant of sexual preference, gender. There's much less issues, and I just found that it was what attracted me. And actually, when I was
campaigning back in London, and I met with councillors from the three main political parties, and I found the people that I met from the Liberal Democrats were, and the same is true here, were very affable and very much campaigning.
But isn't that flexibility a bit of a weakness too? I mean, if we look at what's going on in Westminster, for example, you know, the Nick Clegg and the Liberal Democrat MPs really do hold the balance of power, yet they haven't really, it seems, been able to capitalise on that. And only the really major issues, such as the economy or student fees, this kind of thing. And certainly, I mean, if you go back into time, you'll find that if you hold the balance of power between the two main parties, you can squeeze almost, you know, whatever you want in order to give your allegiance to one party or another. And that hasn't really happened. At least that's the perception of most people in this country with the Liberal Democrats. So the flexibility could also be a weakness. And you're now seen as a party by some people as just simply propping up a Tory government and having really no voice at all.
I think the country spoke quite clearly that it did not want the Labour government to carry on, but it didn't say who it did want. We ended up with the Conservative Party being the largest party, but having no overall control. If the Liberal Democrats had wanted to form a coalition with the Labour Party, then they would have had to have another party on board. And when you try having more and more people trying to drive different agendas, you would not have got a stable government. I think at the moment we have got a stable government that is doing a good job of trying to tidy up the mess left by the previous Labour administration and the bankers that it failed to regulate. But that's something, you know, I would rather we had a stable government than something that, you know, an election, oh, the coalition's fallen apart, another election. That's not something that's going to deliver very, very fast outcomes to try and get us out of the financial situation we're in. So it's a case of sometimes you have to work with people, just as we do in Bristol City Council. We have to work with the other parties. I think the fact that you can put aside some of your political differences is actually and work with someone is a strength, not a weakness.
There's quite a lot of voters that don't want you to do that. They want you to assert your political differences with the Conservatives in the coalition.
And we have asserted those. If you look at the health and adult health, what people are calling the NHS bill, I can't remember.
The health and social,
health
care,
and social
bill, yeah.
care bill. That's been amended and amended and amended. And that's because the Liberal Democrats are in government and have that influence.
Okay, we're going to have a listen to that in a minute as part of our coverage of this week's Prime Minister's Questions, which fascinatingly had Nick Clegg versus Harriet Harman for a change. And we're also joined by political economist Polly Winch. Hi, Polly.
Good evening.
Now, this week, David's just been talking about the glowing record of the coalition economically. Let's start by talking about Greece, because we've had, this is about a week ago or so, a big debt write-down of some sort. So can you just tell us you know, what you think's been happening there and what the consequences will be?
Well, I spent Wednesday in the library trying to figure it out, going through the Financial Times, looking at all the ridiculously large numbers. And basically, as I understand it, Greece's debt is decided to be too big. So Greece has too much debt. So in order to reduce the debt, the government has exchanged with the investors bonds, which is what the debt is denominated in. So it has exchanged bonds worth, for example, €1 so it's taken the €1 bonds from the investors and given them back bonds that are worth, say, 30 cents. So the investors have lost a lot of money. However, this sounds like an all right thing, but what's happened is that lots of Greece's national banks are actually the holders of these bonds. Now, because there's certain regulations saying that the banks have to hold a certain amount of other people's debt in order to meet their capital requirements, this means that the banks now need more money, essentially. So the next thing is that there now needs to be a bailout by the government of Greece to give the banks the money that the banks have lost because Greece has done this debt restructuring. So that necessitates more money from the government, so a national bank bailout, which means that the government needs to borrow more money, which means that the government has to borrow money from the EU, and in order to get the money from the EU, the government has to meet a debt target. So it now basically has to lower its overall debt level to 120% of its economic output by 2020, which is only really necessitated by the bailout, which is needed because of the because the government is bailing out the banks because of the debt restructuring. So if that made any sense at all, it's basically a vicious kind of cycle, and I'm not really sure how Greece or any other country that's in this situation is going to be able to get out of it.
I suppose the long and short of it is, does that now mean that they, through taxation in Greece, they will actually be able to pay this debt off eventually? Or is it, you know, is it more likely or less likely with this change?
Well, I think it's much less likely, because basically the debt's increasing. As the debt increases, Greece is unable to meet the targets. And so, I mean, basically there's the EU is requiring Greece to have a certain amount to, well, like I've just said, to keep its, to lower its overall debt level. But in order to do that, it's having to raise taxes and reduce its spending. So, I mean, the long and the short of it basically is that this is hitting the Greek citizens, and it's kind of going to spiral out of control if it carries on along this trajectory.
What about our economy here, though? Because we keep hearing, don't we, that the actual total amount of debt in Britain is going up. What's your, I mean, it's been a while since you've been in here. What's your take on what's been happening since we last spoke to you? And do you think we're any nearer to actually solving this financial crisis?
No, not at all. And I really don't think it's something that can be solved. I think by design, it's sort of unsolvable.
Is it one of those things that you think is just going to have to be simply, the debt is just going to have to be written off and not paid?
Well, like I've said before, and I would just keep on saying, I think there needs to be a truly independent inquiry into the causes of the financial crisis. And I think, you know, there's been fraud committed, and, you know, I think there's been some very dodgy dealings right at the top. And until, you know, that sort of stuff is uncovered, then we can't really even think about solving it, because I'm not even sure that the debt is real, if that makes any sense.
Well, they've got a Goldman Sachs this week, haven't they? They've had one of their employees spectacularly resign with a letter to the New York Times, really saying that his former employers were a bunch of spivs, effectively. So maybe the evidence is mounting up that will lead to criminal prosecutions.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite surprised at the sort of publicity that the letter got, because I thought that was fairly kind of common knowledge, really, about Goldman Sachs. But, you know, it's kind of, are we only going to focus on the private banks, or do we also need to look at the role of governments and regulators and those sorts of institutions as well in the construction of the crisis?
I suppose there is this side of potential criminality and fraud, but then there's also the other side of it all, which is, you know, how are we going to actually stop the effects that this is having, this financial situation, on things like our schools and hospitals?
But for me, as I understand it, if you could prove the financial crisis and the debt incurred through it as fraudulent and as something that's been deliberately kind of constructed, then, you know, there needn't be the cuts, because, you know, the amount of money that we supposedly need to give to the banks is not it's not a real debt. It's fraud.
David Willingham, you're a local Lib Dem councillor. What do you think? Do you think there's what Polly's saying there is that there isn't actually a need for cutting right now? What we need to do is deal with the financial situation in a different way, rather than continuing to try and pay these debts off that it looks like won't be payable.
I think the problem for Greece, if we look at that, is that the Eurozone took on some countries whose economic management was not very good. So we have strong economies in Northern Europe. We have the German economy, the French economy. And when the currencies merged, if you can look at this in the United States, if you look at what's correct, what the good interest rate is set by the US Federal Reserve, what's good for California is not what's good for Montana, for example. But because there's one currency, you have to have one interest rate. If you take that to the Eurozone, then you find that interest rate is either going to be good for Germany and bad for Greece, or good for Greece and bad for Germany.
Could it be in a situation where it's not really about whether it's good for one place or another, it's whether it's good for the banks? They're calling the tune.
And what I would say about Greece is, Greece coming back to just finish the point, Greece cannot devalue its currency. That would have been in the past, I think, and I'm not a trained economist, so I believe that if they devalued their currency, they would have been able to take a different way out of this. With regard to the banks, there has been a huge amount of financial irresponsibility. You look at the...
Would you go so far as to say fraud, was what we were talking about with Polly?
I wouldn't say fraud without having evidence of it, because I think an investigation needs to be started to see what happened and to find out why there was inadequate controls. But it seems that what happens is a cycle. We only have to look back in history, and you find that there were huge economic crashes, usually because people were investing with money that was borrowed. And if you borrow against a non-tangible asset, if you borrow to buy a house, then if all goes wrong, there's a house that can be a property that can be sold. If you borrow to buy shares, then when the company goes bust, there's no asset that can be recovered. And I think it's to do with borrowing money for the wrong reasons, part of it. And if you look at how people are in debt, if you borrow to buy a house and you get take out a mortgage, you're borrowing responsibly, provided it's within your means to make your mortgage repayments. If you borrow to buy flat screen TVs or other consumer goods that very rapidly lose their value, or the various things that don't hold their value, then that's irresponsible borrowing.
But isn't that what happens with deregulation?
Yeah.
Is that people are able to trade in all sorts of things that may be worth something and not, Polly?
But you're talking about deregulation and the banks calling the shots, but take Greece's recent bailout, right? It's 174 billion euros. Now, the first payment of 40 billion euros is going to recapitalise the banking sector. Now, the only reason that the banking sector needs this money is because of the capital requirements, which are regulations, which are new. They were installed in, like, 1987. So that's not deregulation, that's regulation that's
been
added.
And of course that's going to mean that it's actually more difficult for the banks to lend if they need to keep their money as a capital asset.
Absolutely.
They can't actually lend it. So by regulating the banks, we're actually making things worse, potentially, Polly.
That's exactly it.
What's the way out of this then?
I just think the main regulation that seems, in my opinion, to have caused this financial crisis is this capital requirement. And like you say, getting banks to hoard debt, so that means basically they can't lend money out. Now, that's what the credit crunch was. It was a freezing of lending. And this is why the government, governments are increasingly in debt and they're having to borrow from the European Financial Stability Fund. And so, I mean, in my mind, I think we get rid of that regulation. It was introduced in 1987. It's a new thing. And in my opinion, that's what's caused the financial crisis.
What about this whole business of quantitative easing? Maybe both of you can give your take on this, because this all goes to the banks, doesn't it? Surely some of this quantitative easing money could be actually spent into the economy, David.
I think if people could get a mortgage at 0.5% and borrow from the Bank of England, they would be very happy. And what I think you have to be careful of when you say the banks is to separate what is good banking from what is bad banking.
So do we have some good banks out there?
It's not good banks and bad banks. It's the good sectors of the banks, and it's the bad sectors.
I see you nodding as well, Polly. What are your thoughts on good on bad banks?
Well, shall I...
Yeah, go on.
As I say, I'm not an economist, so I'll try my best. But the consumer side of banking, where you're providing people with money to buy houses, where you're moving money around so that people have got current accounts, savings accounts, that type of retail banking, that is something that is a service to most members of the public. The type of banking that is problematic is the casino style, let's gamble on these shares in this company and hope they go up by a couple of pence in a few milliseconds,
well,
and then
told,
try and sell
we're
them
told
again.
By the end of the decade that's going to be finished, isn't it? But it's a long time to wait, Polly.
Well, I've said before, I think that whole, I mean, people call it a casino side of things. If you're talking about share prices, and I totally agree with you. And since we've kind of had share indices that, you know, do track things by milliseconds, you know, there's a huge amount of profit to be made from nothing occurring in reality, but something only occurring on an index, on a tracker, and that was made possible through technological advances. And same true of derivatives.
And to give you an idea of how this affects people, a real world example, all the council officers in what was Avon, there is a pension fund that holds shares as a long-term investment. If it needs to sell those shares, because it's not a multi-billion pound bank, it will not be able to do it quick enough and will be beaten by one of the big players such as Goldman Sachs, and it won't get the best deal. And the shares are there because the companies that you invest in pay dividends, and hopefully the assets that they have rise over time, and that's a good thing for the pension funds to invest in. But when someone is making a profit on the fact that they can take a millisecond or a really quick trade and make some money out of someone else's pension, then really that's not a good side of banking.
I wonder, Polly, I don't know what your thoughts are, whether this letter from Greg Smith, the resignation letter, where he's calling Goldman Sachs Muppets, is a kind of psyop, because they're not. They seem to be pretty clever and pretty sneaky.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Goldman Sachs is interesting for two reasons, really. One is the kind of financial side of things and the intangibleness of what they deal in generally, you know, kind of trading and just making money off the trade rather than actually off an appreciation in the value of the asset. And the other is the way that so many members of different, Greece's new prime minister is an ex-Goldman Sachs employee, and how Goldman Sachs employees now seem to be in governments all over the world, you know, in charge of countries' finance ministries and things like that. So, I mean, Goldman is an interesting institution.
They're not Muppets if they can wheedle their way into the Treasury, are they?
There's also a brain drain. If you look at people who are qualified in STEM subjects, which is science, technology, engineering and maths, large banks are employing these people to work in their derivatives or their the computer side of things, the high-tech side of things, to do these, implement these trading models to get that extra millisecond to do that. And that's taking away from the engineering, the maths capabilities of the country. You know, we have lots of qualified graduates coming out of university, and if your engineering company can't match the salary of a bank and take someone into that industry, they're lost from, you know, their career takes a different path, and you lose someone who could be the next innovator of something that will help this the economy.
And it sounds to me like the banks are letting the side down completely, and you know, something needs to be done about it at some point. The bankers' crimes will come home to roost.
Although I'd go back to David's earlier point about you need to be careful to differentiate between types of banks or banking. You know, there is a very kind of necessary function that banking plays in our economy, and, you know, they basically lend long term and borrow short term and allow us to kind of buy houses and do the things that we want and need to do. And then there is the whole kind of Goldman Sachs side of things, which is just trading and the kind of financial markets, which seems to have not only escalated out of control but perhaps be unnecessary.
Okay, well, let's zoom in on Westminster now and go to Prime Minister's questions from this week, which is particularly special because we had David Cameron away in the United States having some sort of love in with Barack Obama, obviously talking about Afghanistan because of the horrendous massacre by a or several, it's still not clear whether it was a whole group of drunken American soldiers conducting this massacre last weekend, and leaving Nick Clegg, as usual, to take the flak. So let's go to Prime Minister's questions and have a listen to that now.
Harriet Harman.
We'll compare what our government did on the NHS with what his government is doing any day. And he says the problem with this bill is that doctors and nurses just don't understand it. But the problem is that they do. However, even at this late stage, it's within his power to stop this bill. Next Monday, the bill reaches its final stage in the House of Lords. There are 90 Lib Dem peers. Their votes will decide whether or not this bill becomes law. Will he instruct Shirley Williams and his peers to vote to stop the bill?
Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Lady has invited me to make a comparison. Let me make three comparisons.
Order! I say it again, the response must be heard. And that's all there is to it. The Deputy Prime Minister.
The Right Honourable Lady has invited me to make comparisons. Let me make three comparisons. The Shadow Health Secretary has said it is irresponsible to increase NHS spending. So they don't believe in more money for the NHS. We do. Comparison one. Secondly, they indulge the private sector with sweetheart deals, which we are making illegal in this bill. They want sweetheart deals with the private sector. We do not. They presided over inequality in the NHS, which again, we are making a statutory obligation in this bill to deliver a more equal outcome in the NHS, which they failed to deliver in 13 years.
Yeah. Harriet Harman.
The absolute rubbish. And undermining the NHS and making Shirley Williams vote for it, he's trashed not one, but two national treasures. He didn't need to sign the bill, but he did. He could stop the bill, but he won't. He says the Lib Dems make a difference, but they don't. What has happened to that fine liberal tradition? They must be turning in their graves. William Gladstone, the party of David Lloyd George, now the party of Nick Clegg.
I know she has her pre-prepared script, which she sticks to religiously, but it's worth actually having a question and answer session. That's what this whole thing is actually about. What we're doing on this side of the House, the two parties which have come together in the coalition, is sort out the banking system which she left in a mess. Sort out the public finances, which she left in a mess. To sort out the economy, which she left in a mess. To stop the arbitrary privatisation of the NHS, which she left in a mess. Do you know what? In government, the Labour Party ran out of ideas, of money. In opposition, they're running out of ideas.
That was Nick Clegg there with Harriet Harman, the Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, at Prime Minister's Questions. Now, David Willingham, you're a Lib Dem councillor here in Bristol. Could you just give us your take there? Because it seemed to me a bit cheeky of Nick Clegg there, saying that she had a pre-prepared speech, and then he sort of led his pre-prepared speech, which is a whole sort of litany of disastrous things that the Labour Party has done. Now, this isn't really holding water so much nowadays, is it? Because it's 2 years nearly since the Lib Dem coalition with the Tories has been in power, and yet they're still blaming the present problems on the previous government the whole time. And this is an argument which holds less and less water as time goes on.
It is an argument that will hold less and less water as time goes on, but it takes an enormous amount of time to turn around an economy.
But you're not turning it around. You're not even starting. Things are getting worse, aren't they? The debt is getting worse.
I have to say, bigger. I don't have the figures.
We've just gone over a trillion a few months ago of debt. So, you know, the debt is getting bigger still.
And it's a case of it depends what that debt is being used for. You know, Bristol City Council borrowed money responsibly to invest in capital projects. So turning this situation round is pretty much like stopping an oil tanker. It's going to take a lot of time.
By the time of the next election, is Nick Clegg still going to be saying, oh, it's all the fault of the Labour Party from the previous government?
I hope not. I hope we can turn this economy can be turned round. It depends on so many factors that are not in the control of Nick Clegg.
And do you
they're
think
not
I
in
mean
the control of Barack Obama? They're not in the control of David Cameron. They're
global financial things. There's all manner of things in the global economy. There could be natural disasters. There are so many variables that it's really difficult to say, I can turn this round.
Doesn't sound like decisive leadership. But anyway, the National Health Service could be dying in the next few days. It's essentially a privatisation. I mean, I will certainly call it that. If you look at what's happening, it's the biggest ever change to the health service, which has brought it towards this whole sort of privatised. I mean, if you look at what they're doing, is any willing provider does allow, companies, private companies, to be bidding for this NHS work. Of course, what they're going to be doing is they're going to be bidding for the parts of the NHS that they can make the most profit of, leaving the public to pick up the bill for the most difficult parts of healthcare. And it could be that your party is tarred with the brush of allowing the privatisation of the one of the greatest health services in the world, or a national treasure.
I think the privatisation of the NHS started under Labour with the PFI deals, which privatised the profit and nationalised the risk. The real problem is that is very opaque, and getting any figures from what's happening with PFI is really difficult. I think things that are transparent, where you can actually see what's happening, would be an improvement. Now, the bill, I did try and look at the bill because I anticipated that it would come up. It's 427 pages long. It's not something that very many people will probably have read in full. Given the workload as a councillor and someone that works in a day job as well, trying to read a bill that long is very difficult. So you have to rely on journalists, the media, and various different political parties, all of whom will put their own particular spin on it.
But hang on, those journalists are also relying on you.
Yeah.
Polly, what's your thoughts on the exchange between Nick Clegg and Harriet Harman? How do you think they both did?
Well, it's just kind of similar to most PMQs, really, it seems. Quite a lot of jeering, a lot of shouting, and not really much substance. So from that clip, I'm still at a loss as to what the debate between Labour and the Lib Dems is over the NHS. What is it that Labour would specifically do or wants to change in the bill that the Lib Dems are unprepared to?
What about the performance, though, of either Nick Clegg or Harriet Harman, or both? Or do you think it actually makes any difference having a different character in there?
I'm not sure how many people listen to Prime Minister's questions or pay it much attention. I know it's perhaps people that are really interested in politics do. I mean, for me, the whole thing is just part of, I suppose, the political culture of Westminster, and doesn't really speak a lot to, you know, the ordinary person.
Well, I'm going to see if I can convince you that it is worth listening to, because we're going to have another clip now, and this one from Jeremy Corbyn about housing.
Jeremy Corbyn, on Monday, the housing minister told me and told the House that the government had no plans or wish to introduce rent controls in the private sector. Is the Deputy Prime Minister aware that the rising of private sector rents in central London, the capping of housing benefits, means in effect that many families on benefit are being forced out? It's a process of social cleansing that's going on. Will he give a commitment that the government will examine the case for private sector rent controls?
Mr. Speaker, as he knows, we have, at the same time as announcing the restraint on the housing benefit budget, which was a commitment in his own party's manifesto to bring that that part of the benefit system under control, we've accompanied that with a major fund to deal with hard cases. We've also, of course, unveiled a number of measures which should lead to a significant increase in the building of affordable homes. It is the lack of supply of affordable homes that is the underlying problem in London and elsewhere in the country.
That was Nick Clegg responding to a question by the Labour MP Jeremy Corbyn at Prime Minister's Questions this week. Polly, have I managed to convince you that it was a worthwhile point to bring up or not?
Yeah, absolutely. That was a worthwhile point. And, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I've never tried to buy my own house, but he's talking about the lack of supply of affordable homes being the problem.
But also the rent as well, saying that the rents are very high. I mean, of course, this is, for most people, is their major outgoing, whether it's paying your mortgage or paying the rent to the landlord, isn't it? And, you know, as electricity prices go up, you start to look at the income versus the amount of money that you've got to pay in rent and energy prices, and you start to see that's where the squeeze is taking place.
But this is one of the things, and this relates to what you were saying about the NHS, David, in terms of the public-private finance, kind of when the public and the private sector, basically the public sector pays private subcontracts the work out. And so, for example, you've got, you know, housing that's supported by the council that can cost, you know, almost up to £300 a week for like a very, very small kind of standard, you know, small room with a shared kitchen. And so, you know, there's no way that if that service wasn't being run for profit, that it would cost £300 a week. It would probably cost £100. And so, you know, once you've got that as your basic model, basically the taxpayer is subsidising the private sector. So the public sector is subsidising the private sector, which is exactly what will happen with the NHS as well.
There is also a fact that, you know, the actual price of buying a house, whatever it is, £200,000, in no way reflects the actual cost it would be to put those bricks on top of each other and to build a house. David?
From the point of view of rent control, This is the really difficult political argument between whether how much regulation should governments put onto private industry, and it's whether housing is a private matter or whether it's a public service, and this is a very difficult argument. Bristol, like every other local authority, provides council housing, but the waiting lists are huge, and it's trying to build more council houses to make sure that the housing stock that you have can be used. You want people to be accommodated in property that's appropriate.
I think, but if you can't build your council housing, you're having to pay housing benefit, aren't you, out of the council budget to these private landlords, some of whom have got loads of houses and are raking it in.
Yeah, and the problem is that there is already a cap on housing benefit. I think the problem that was specifically raised in the question is to do with rents in central London. And this is something that, because of the density of already property that's already built, people don't want to necessarily live in tower blocks anymore. So we need a different way of getting the population density, and this is a very London specific question because of the sheer amount.
But we have high rents in Bristol in places like Clifton. You know, we're going to end up, surely, if there isn't some kind of rent capping of private landlords, with a real ghettoisation.
I think that cities generally are, to some extent, divided anyway by the private sector. What you have to be careful of with saying that there should be public and government intervention is accusations of gerrymandering and people manipulating where the electorate are placed.
Like the Boundary Commission things that are going on at the moment, which seem to be benefiting the Conservative Party. Anyway, we're joined now by Marina Morris. Marina, what have you got for us today?
Hello. Today we will speak about removing a child from its parents. In recent years, the practices of social workers in deciding when to remove a child from its home have been heavily influenced by extreme cases where a child has been killed by the adults trusted to care for them. Following the death of Victoria Clumby in 2000, local education and social services were merged into a single department with the idea that the better communication between teachers and social workers could help to prevent a similar future occurrence. There were a number of unintended consequences. Frequently, director of educational, such as Sharon Shoesmith, this excellent educational credential but little former experience of social work, were appointed to head the new departments. Under a slogan, "Every child matters," money was pumped into educational starting breakfast and home clubs, a vote winner for working parents, but channeled away from the most vulnerable children. In 2007, another child, 70-month-old baby P, Peter Connolly, was tragically murdered at the hands of his mother and others. The social workers involved were vilified, and under order of from Ed Balls, Shoesmith was dismissed, unfairly according to the Supreme Court. Despite many warning signs, Connolly was not taken away from his mother's care. Details of the BBP case started to come out in 2008. Consequently, social workers and local authorities became increasingly unwilling to leave a child with its parents when they become involved. To take a child into care, a local authority needs to make an application to the court via the Children and Family Courts Advisory Service, CAFCAS. In April 2008, CAFCAS received 380 applications. This almost three times more to 903 applications in January 2012 and 878 in February 2012. The trend shows this number is likely to increase. The number of children killed by their parents or infanticide has remained fairly constant for the last 30 years, despite all of these changes. About 75% of these children go into the care of foster parents, but there are not enough willing foster parents, especially from immigrants' community. A quarter will end up in security units, children homes, hostel, and special schools. But according to shelter, when they leave social care after 18, they are more likely than the general population to become homeless, and they are more likely to end up in prison. What does every child matter mean? The fundamental law underpinning this social work is the 1989 Children's Act, which protects the welfare of the child. It does not mention parental rights. The parents frequently view it as an abuser, even if this is not mentioned. Their suffering and tears are not deemed relevant. There is a balance between the damage which can be done to a child by poor parenting and that which can be done to the child by care system itself. Be aware that state decision makers are more likely to use the full force of the law and the state to remove children from their homes. What do the people of Bristol think about some of these issues? The Children's Act 1989 refers to the welfare of the child, but not the parents. Is this right?
I think you should protect them both, really, because it's not always the parents' fault. Could something happen to a child, but they've got no rights. Obviously, children are the most important from us. Not because they just can't help themselves.
I think it's right, yeah.
Obviously, I don't know. Sometimes it depends what the parents are going through at the same time. Maybe once the child's been taken into care, maybe there should be a little bit more help for the adults afterwards.
The child hasn't really got much control over, he's not really as responsible for his faults as the parents. So obviously, if there's a reason for the child to be taken off the parent who has got full responsibility.
Imagine a mother lost a child because she was in a bad situation when the child was born or whatever, going through some stuff. I think it's not right for the parent not to have the help to try and better their lives to be able to maybe get their kids back afterwards.
I think the investigation should be more thorough, innit?
It's always much healthier to grow up with your parents.
I'd say the percentage is more 80-20, so obviously 80% of it does need to focus on the child's welfare. The other 20%, the parents should be considered.
No, I think it needs to be both of them. That parent's given birth to the child, and it's not fair that that is taken away from them. Depends on the circumstances, obviously, but I think it needs to be seen from both sides.
Is removing a child from its parents the safe option for children's services staff in marginal cases to the detriment of many children?
I'd say it's probably safer for the staff than it is for the children, the situation they're in. So I'd say you've got to weigh out the pros and cons.
So it's basically saying, the staff that the child services get, maybe sometimes it's detrimental to the children because the staff aren't really regulated as much as they should be. Because, everyone hears about stuff that goes on in children's homes and sometimes it's not right.
The staff that they use should be people that are prepared for the situations that could occur.
I sometimes I believe it's detrimental to the children, but more times than not, it's better for the children if the parents is that bad to live with the parents.
Thinking like I said earlier, we should always try harder to find solutions, not to separate the children from the parents.
But depends. I mean, every case of children could be different. I don't think the same thing should be applied to each case. I think maybe they should all be considered and stuff like that.
I doubt they take children away unless they absolutely have to. I suspect most children that are taken away from their parents are at risk for abuse of various sorts. So no, I don't agree with that, really.
think it's very difficult to remove a child from its parents. If it has to be done, it has to be done. But I think if there's a way to avoid doing it, that should be sought out. I think that should only happen on very rare cases, really.
It is a safe option, yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, I agree that they should have the power to take to remove that child immediately. I know that at the moment they need the police with them to do that. They don't have that authority.
Should struggling parents be offered parental education or warning before removal of their children?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. There's so many young parents that just don't know how to raise the children yet. They probably need some help, either education or financial support. And yeah, if there is any problem, I think they should be given a warning, in a letter or verbally.
Education,
definitely.
Of course, you should be warned before. Sometimes it's just they don't understand that there's something wrong, but it's not they do it on purpose. It's just they focus on some other things. Maybe they work too much. If they give him a warning, that would shake him up or wake him up and understand they're doing something wrong.
But I think the problem is nearly often poverty rather than anything else, or they've not been parented well themselves. So how can they possibly give out a love they didn't receive themselves? So support of some sort would be good.
I think, yeah, definitely they should be provided with some sort of education, and definitely, yeah, a warning. They're not really going to learn if their child's just taken away from them. They might have another child and do exactly the same.
Yes, if it's something minor, but if it's a more serious case like child abuse or something like that, then no. So yeah, it varies from case to case, but on the more minor issues, then yeah, I think they should be offered some form of parenting education.
Yes. Yeah, definitely more education needs to be done. I know that Bernardo's in NSPCC, they have educational classes going on for parents at the moment. So I think more education around that, and definitely warnings.
Now, David Willingham, you're a Lib Dem local councillor here. You were talking about this earlier on, weren't you, saying that it's part of your corporate responsibility to be a parent to the many of these children we're talking about here. Do you think we've got the balance right between the rights of the local authority and people like you and the rights of the parents?
I think that the primary objective must always be to protect the child. I don't think our officers involved in child protection, safeguarding, have what must be a very difficult job. You need to look at the BBC came in and were allowed to film over 3 years with no guarantee of getting any footage because people could withdraw at any time. The cases that came up, the sort of heart-rendering pictures that you saw of parents who were drug addicts who were trying to turn their lives around and had to make what must be an almost impossible decision as to whether they could look after their child. It just shows you the real difficulty that social workers are experiencing day to day.
But the problem is obviously here, and the many lawyers have said this too, is with the family courts, which are incredibly secretive. So these decisions are being made without really any proper public scrutiny.
I think when it's a child going through the judicial process, you have a great deal of protection issues that need to be there to make sure that that child is protected when they become an adult, that there's nothing, people won't be able to trace back to their past and use things against them.
Okay, Polly, because we're coming towards the end of the hour, Polly, do you want to say anything about this, the balance between the local authority and the courts and the parents of children, which Marina's been given a pretty good look through there?
I think personally my own opinion is that I'm slightly sceptical about any kind of entity having the power to, you know, remove a human being from its family. And obviously, like you say, you know, children do need to be protected, but I think there's a very careful line that you need to tread, really.
Thank you. Right, well, that's just about it for the first hour. Coming up now, the Sky News at 6. That's Rupert Murdoch's Sky News. Thanks to this week's guest, who was Lib Dem councillor for Bishopston, Dr. David Willingham. After the news...